Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast, the first podcast of the 2009-2010 offseason, along with Aaron Fitt. I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for the download. We're actually going to talk some professional baseball today after Connor and Nathan dropped some draft knowledge on you from Jupiter. And, Aaron, I'm not sure if we can match their passion and enthusiasm, because those two guys were both pumped and jacked coming from Jupiter. But the two of us are Red Sox fans, basking in the not-so-glow of the 27th World Championship of the Yankees. I'm looking forward to Joe Girardi in his 28 jersey next year. That's a kind of a cheesy That's easy to make fun of. But I thought it was an uninspired postseason with a pretty decent World Series, really highlighted by Pedro Martinez, you know, for me.
Yeah, I agree.
At least it's game two performance.
Maybe that's the Red Sox fans in us talking, John. But I mean, I was very excited to see the drama of Pedro against the Yankees once again.
But twice. I wanted to see it once.
I only wanted to see it once. You know, you just had a bad feeling that the second time around wasn't going to be so good. He only had 5 days rest, you know, which nowadays isn't enough for Pedro. It was... He gave it his best out there. He gave us one more classic Pedro performance, and it was six innings and two runs. And he almost won.
That's pretty much the bottom line is Pedro was barely the number two starter on the Red Sox 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And then the Phillies asked him to be the number two starter this year, and that's why they ultimately, in my mind, why they lost that series. And they did match with the Yankees fairly well, but I do give the Yankees, for all their payroll advantages, and they exercised them very well. I think you do have to give credit to Brian Cashman for when they had money, they spent it more wisely this year than they have in the past. They recognized they didn't have great defense. Okay, let's bring in A.J. Burnett. He's worth more to the Yankees than to other teams because they don't have good defense. Let's get a strikeout guy in here. CeCe Sabathia and Mark Teixeira were no-brainers. It went to the highest bidder, and those were both great players. To A-Rod's credit, he responded not having to be the man. And with Teixeira around, that definitely seemed to help A-Rod, and A-Rod was tremendous in the postseason. A six-game World Series, good to have. I think it was good that the best postseason series of the year was the World Series, and the TV ratings reflected it. I think they also reflected the fact that the Yankees were involved. People were attracted by Pedro against the Yankees. That storyline held some resonance. So good for baseball to have good TV ratings. And just to finish this topic here, and is it good for baseball or bad for baseball the Yankees win a World Series like that?
I think it's good for baseball in the end. I agree, John, with I think a year-long standing theory that it's good for sports to have those juggernauts that everybody loves to hate. It's good to have the brand names be healthy. And I think you and I both thought it was good for college baseball to have LSU in Texas in the national championship.
Absolutely.
Especially after the last few years when you had Fresno and Oregon State. And those were good stories. But, I think that there's a lot of power in that brand name. And even the Yankees fans, who understand that money, the payroll had a lot to do with this thing, I mean, obviously, but...
Absence, I think, made the heart grow fonder for a lot of Yankees fans.
Sure. I think this one meant a little bit more to them in a lot of ways, especially after they've seen the Red Sox win two since they've last won one, and I think they really wanted this one.
I think so, and the one other thing to throw out there is it does make you realize, if you didn't already, just how ridiculously good Mariano Rivera is.
Yeah.
I mean, if that guy's not a unanimous Hall of Famer, no, I mean, they're a Hall of Fame. They've never been, I guess, what, Tom Seaver, 98.6% is the highest percentage of votes. It's not like it really matters. If you're in the Hall of Fame, you're in the Hall of Fame. Whether you're a wall scraper like Jim Rice or Tom Seaver, they have the same plaques.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, one's more deserving than the other. But Mariano Rivera, to me, if anyone looks at that guy and says, that's not a Hall of Famer, they're insane. I mean... He's the difference. He's the difference in that dynasty. And I do think it's good for the best brand name in baseball to be strong. It is better for it to be strong but not a dynasty.
Yes.
I think the only sports – I think the bigger the sport, the worse it is to have a dynasty. I don't think it was good for competitive balance in baseball when the Yankees won three in a row and 4-5. That wasn't great. But that works in the NBA. You know, for whatever reason, it works in the NBA. Maybe it's the fewer teams that get in your playoffs, the worse it is to have a dynasty. Because in the NFL, I don't think it's great when there's the Patriots, if they won three in a row or that kind of thing.
I have to disagree with you there.
Of course you do. I think it's better, and I think it's better that the Patriots and the Steelers and the Colts win one here or there as opposed to several in a row. Because part of the NFL's conceit is parity.
Sure.
Which, you know, they don't have any parity this year. or in several recent years, honestly. I think it's gotten worse of late. But, you know, in the NBA and the NHL, where more teams make it, it seems like for those leagues, it's just okay if your team makes the playoffs. You don't have to win. And it's great if you have dynasties in those. Those two leagues seem to be better off almost when they have dynastic teams. That's a whole other podcast. That's another show, I think. But congratulations to the Yankees, and I won't say congratulations to Yankees fans. I think of you as I think of Duke fans. So that's all I got to say about that. Aaron, we're on the National League East Top 10 Prospects, a team the Yankees vanquished, the Phillies organization that I did for their Top 10 Prospects and Top 30. And at the other end of the Yankees and Phillies spectrum are the Nats,
yeah.
The organization whose Top 10 you have done. And you have covered the Nationals / Expos since basically your first month at BA,
yeah.
When you took over doing their organization report when English language media stopped covering the Montreal Expos.
Yeah, this
is my favorite all-time story.
This is my sixth Nationals top 30 list.
That is punishment, man. I can't believe we do that to you.
You know, we've had some ups and downs over the last 6 years. I think that there's been one constant, Ian Desmond.
that's awesome.
I think he's been in every one of these write-ups.
That is so awesome. You're right. He was a 2004 high school draft,
yeah.
And he's still eligible now after his big league debut.
Right.
And he's
rocketed back up to number 4 on the list, too, John. After
is this the highest he's ever been?
I think he was number 4 in about 05 or 06 a while back.
That's pretty funny.
He was number 19 last year. He was kind of wallowing in the mid to back section of the list for a while. Great to see Ian Desmond have a bounce-back year for the Nationals. I still don't know how good of a big leaguer he's going to be, but...
The opportunity is certainly there for
there.
Him.
It's there, yeah.
He might make our top 20 rookies next year.
He does have tools.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a matter of... It's always been a matter of consistency and a matter of hitting.
I think it looks
like the bat's coming around.
It does look like the bat's coming around. He definitely hit in the Eastern League this year. I have positive reports on his bat. I think defensively, the whole question is just making the routine play.
Right.
He doesn't make the routine play consistently enough, and... I put myself through this. I watch some Nationals games. I watch quite a few games, almost always with a mute button on for fear of Rob Dibble hurting my brain. But I did watch him in the big leagues, and you could see the scouting reports were true. He makes some bonehead plays. He doesn't.
Right.
He's not always engaged, it seems like, defensively. And boy, I sure hope he's going to be the big league shortstop next year. But obviously, the Nationals. Steven Strasburg. And Derek Norris, those are two easy top guys. It looks, by the looks of your top 10, though, Aaron, you had a little bit more trouble fleshing out the rest of that list.
Yeah, I like Danny Espinosa at number 5. I think
it's
an exciting prospect, a guy who's a really good defensive shortstop. He's a switch hitter with surprising pop, and I think he's a quality guy there in the middle of this list. I think Chris Marrero, I still think he's a solid number 6 guy. He's still just 21 years old. I think he's going to hit. I think he's going to have power. After that, I think this list drops off a cliff.
Yeah, talk about opportunity. If Chris Marrero comes in healthy next spring, I mean, who's the Nationals' first baseman? I guess it's Adam Dunn.
Yeah.
Who's obviously pretty good, but
right.
He's terrible at first base. He might be worse. He might be a bigger problem at first base than he is in left field.
Yeah, despite Adam Dunn's spot on the 2010 lineup here in right field, I think. is that what it says?
He is in right field. Holy shnikes.
I think we all agree that Adam Dunn is not a long-term solution in Washington. I think your nephew, John, might beg to differ. But,
that's right.
I think Chris Marrero is the future there at first base. It's not going to be next year, but he might be 2 years away.
He's not a bad 6.
He's not a bad number 6 guy. He was too high as a number 1 guy a couple years ago. But
right.
As a number 6, you're happy with that.
And then Jeff Coburnus at 7 did not have a great debut, but we both like Jeff Coburnus. I think if he'd been in that 11 to 15 range,
sure,
you'd feel pretty good about this organization.
Absolutely. I think he's one of my favorite guys in this draft this year, honestly. It's just I like his skill set. I just think that he's athletic. He's got a really good line drive stroke. He had a slow debut and then he got banged up, but I think he's going to be a good one, but he does seem a little high at 7 given the fact that he hasn't produced in the professional ranks yet.
Yeah, and then Justin Maxwell, Michael Burgess, Destin Hood, three toolsy outfielders of varying ages. I mean, Justin Maxwell is, what, 26?
Yeah, I think so.
It's not a great top 10. On the scale of your Nats history, though, I mean, it still has to rank toward the top of it. They haven't had a player anywhere near the caliber of Strasburg.
Right.
And right now, I mean, we were talking about this yesterday in the office, off air, as it were. Steven Strasburg clearly has the best stuff in there. I mean, I don't even know who their number two starter is in the big league team as of this moment after John Lannon. So, and then Drew Storen, you think Drew Storen has a chance to open next year in the big leagues?
I think he's got a real shot.
I think he has a shot, too. I'll be stunned, actually, if he doesn't. He gave up the game-winning home run, the game-losing home run, in the Rising Stars game in the Arizona Fall League on Saturday, if you happen to see that. But, you know, there have been worse things that have happened than giving up a home run in the Arizona Fall League.
And that's the knock on Drew Storen, though, is that he can be a little bit homer prone. The fastball, when he leaves it up especially, doesn't have a lot of life. It's kind of straight. So he's got to do a better job pitching down in the zone with that. And you know, he's got two really good breaking balls. He's got a curveball and a slider. They're both above average pitches. So.
Any chance that they start Storen or try to start him? I mean,
no chance.
No chance.
He's a reliever all the way. He's just got that kind of a mindset, and that's where he likes to be.
Well, I like Drew Storen, and I think Drew Storen in the Phillies top 10 might rank ninth.
It's a good Phillies list.
I know. I mean, and it seems like when you do a top 10 or top 30, Aaron, you either start to like that organization better than everybody else likes it, you like it less than other people like it. There's really very little in between. And I think I was bullish on the Phillies last year. We put them 12th in the top in our organization talent rankings. And now they've traded prospects 2, 3, 4, and 10 off last year's list. And graduated number 9, Jay Happ, who was one of the better rookies in the major leagues this year.
Right.
And I still think they're going to move up in our organization rankings.
It helps when you've got guys like Michael Taylor stepping forward and just having a huge breakout year.
Yeah. 2020 at Double A and Triple A with 20 homers, 20 stolen bases.
This was a great, it seems like, John, this was a great year developmentally for the Phillies when you've got Dominic Brown, Kyle Drabeck, Michael Taylor, Travis d'Arnaud, all these guys, even Sebastian Baez had a good year as a 19-year-old in the New York Penn League.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of guys here that really stepped forward and just developed well.
It was a good year for them developmentally, you're right. There weren't a lot of significant injuries. They did get a lot of the guys from last year. And the thing is, the Phillies, I'm not usually of this mindset, but Chuck Lamar came in as their new player development director, and he was very aggressive, challenging a lot of their players. Johan Flande, here's a guy who last year wasn't even in their top 30. And that was my mistake. But the reason for that was he was 22 and in the GCL. But the mindset under Mike Arbuckle was much more passive as far as they weren't aggressive in promoting guys. And this year, and that's how you get Michael Taylor last year, starting off in Lakewood. He was a college guy and probably should have been challenged at Clearwater. He had to dominate the South Atlantic League to go up to Clearwater. Chuck Lamar, much more aggressive in promoting guys. And when Travis d'Arnaud struggled in the first half in the South Atlantic League, they didn't demote him. They didn't send him back to extended spring. They left him there, and he had a big second half, helped Lakewood get to the postseason. I think they won the Saturday League title. He was a big part of that. Valle, again, they promoted very aggressively in the first half. He did stumble a little bit at Lakewood, but didn't kill his confidence, hit at Williamsport. Now he's, I think he's second in the Mexican League in home runs as a 19-year-old playing for his native Los Mochis. And there were a lot of other players they were very aggressive with. Domingo Santana, 16/17 Dominican, playing in the GCL, not in a Latin American League. That's an aggressive assignment.
And he held his own. He more than held his own.
And that's why, I mean, the other thing about this system is, I think 10, 15 years ago, this list would have been 10 outfielders, basically. You would have had almost all outfielders except for Drabeck and d'Arnaud. Because they have got 5 tool outfielders out the yin-yang with guys like Juwan James, Kyrell Hudson, to a lesser extent in terms of tools, Kelly Dugan, this author kid they drafted in the 9th round this year out of Arizona High School, which has a really cool name. I forget what it is. I think it's like Sierra del Agua or some crazy name. I know it's Agua Fria High School.
There it is.
Cool Water High School, which would be attractive in Arizona.
Yeah.
So they have incredible athleticism and depth of athleticism.
You didn't even mention Anthony Hewitt, of course.
I know. Or Zach Collier,
exactly.
The two top picks in last year's draft. And I still haven't mentioned their top prospect, Dominic Brown. So it's definitely – it's funny how these things go. You end up remembering who the number one guy was a lot more often. And last year, the first year I did the Phillies, I really thought we went out on a limb with Dominic Brown, but he just seemed like he was our kind of guy, a tooled-up athlete who also had some hitting skills. And he's still quite raw, even for a guy who's had success at Double-A. And, I mean, his power is so unlocked to some people. I had one Eastern League manager who compared him to Omar Moreno. to me this year, which is crazy because he's like 6 feet, 6 inches taller than Omar Moreno was.
Hmm.
But that's how he thought of Brown, as a slap-hitting speedster. And that is because Dominic Brown really does not quite know how to even tap into his power. I think he has the potential to be just a monster and just be a lot better than he already is, but he's already surprisingly patient for a guy who's that raw, and he does have real raw power. I mean, a couple of guys in the organization said, would not surprise me if the guy hits 30 home runs eventually. So,
you know, in the New York Penn League a couple of years ago, I don't know if it was last year or the year before.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Somebody compared him to Daryl Strawberry with the skill set.
The physical.
The
physical comp has been Daryl Strawberry since he signed, that's for sure.
Yeah.
That tall, he's got a little buggy whip in his swing. That comp has been out there, and you don't want to compare anyone to Daryl Strawberry when power is a question, but that's who he looks like, and that's, in some ways, who he plays like. And I still don't think I want to put Strawberry on him, because Strawberry, the other thing is that Strawberry was the number one overall pick, I believe.
Yeah.
And this guy was a 20th-round pick, just great scouting by their area guy.
Strawberry started hitting for power pretty early on in his pro
absolutely
career, right? He didn't have
absolutely
this kind of period where he didn't unlock the power.
I don't believe so. I think the power was always there. I think Daryl Strawberry was a lot less raw coming out of Crenshaw High than Dominic Brown. But it's a fun organization to do, because it's an organization at its peak right now. A lot of fans follow, so there's a lot of interest in it. That is interesting for me. I'm fortunate. I do three organizations that I enjoy doing, and that includes the Yankees, which will be my sixth year, I think, doing Yankees prospects. But those guys are pros, and they have prospects, and it's always a challenge to talk about this with Jim Callis on Instant Messenger. It's always a challenge to see through how an organization sees their guys versus how they're viewed from the outside. I happen to think there are a couple organizations in the game
right
that overhype their prospects, and the Yankees are one of them. It's the Baseball America Podcast. I'm John Manuel. He's Aaron Fitt. The email address is podcast@baseballamerica.com, and we actually got a podcast question. We have our two usuals, Luke Goode and Joe Lucates. And Luke asked about Aaron Fitt's college baseball recruiting rankings. I've enjoyed BA's college baseball recruiting coverage. Florida, Stanford, Arizona State, TCU, and Fullerton, top five. Which other incoming classes and players do you like personally? His personal cheeseball classes, and Luke always gets extra points for using the correct terminology.
Joe uses that as well.
They
caught on with you.
They absolutely. Luke's personal cheeseball classes are Texas, Vanderbilt, and UCLA. And for what it's worth, actually, I have two flavors of cheese ball at home right now, a Parmesan ranch and a sharp cheddar that the wife prefers. Also, at Oregon, number 24, what kind of shape is that program in right now? How long will it take George Horton boys to reach the top of the Pac-10? That one, let's tackle that Oregon one first, Aaron, because last year we ranked their class pretty highly. What, number 10, I think, last year?
10 or 12, and I think it was 10. Yeah.
I think they were 10. Obviously, Oregon found the going a little bit tougher this year in the Pac-10, and maybe they thought.
I think it was not even a
great year in the Pac-10.
I think they were disheartened by how poorly they hit. I mean, they had pretty good arms. They had a good pitching staff last year, but boy, they were a horrible offensive team.
And it was bad.
You know, in talking to George Horton during the season, he just sounded beside himself. It was sad to hear George sound so sad. But
that is sad.
Looking at this class that they brought in, I mean, it's once again, you know, their top recruit is a pitcher, Christian Jones, a guy that I really like, left-hander with exceptional feel for pitching. I think he's going to be a big star in college baseball. But I don't know that they really got a lot of impact bats in this class. I mean, they love Jack Martyr, kind of a scrappy little Red Turner type player, a classic Horton guy.
He's their best bet to hit immediately because he did hit in the California Collegiate League this past summer. I don't remember where we ranked him on that summer league prospect list. I think he made it.
I believe he was on that list.
But people in that league did like him. They liked him just fine. This guy who will hit, his future tools are a little bit in question, but he should hit it at the college level.
I think he's certainly going to be a contributor for them, but what they needed was some thunder in the lineup. I mean, and they're not going to be a team that's going to hit a lot of home runs. That's not their philosophy. That's not their ballpark.
Just someone that you fear. This is the guy, I guess, Stephen Kalpang. He was a former USD recruit, correct?
That's the key. He was a big-time recruit out of high school for San Diego, never developed there, spent last year at Cypress CC. They're hoping that he can step in and be a presence, you know, give them some power in the middle of the lineup. I'm not sold. I mean, I think that the guy,
He struggled as a freshman in USD in the West Coast Conference, which is a good league, but it's not the Pac-10.
I just don't think he's ever going to really hit, and maybe he'll run into some power, but he's a key guy for them, you know, they got some other guys in this class that I think are good sleepers. Andrew Mendenhall is kind of like a poor man's Jake Marisnik, is what they compare him to.
Interesting.
He's very toolsy and athletic, 6'3", physical. That guy could be your pick to click. This is a pretty deep class once again, you know, because they had a lot of junior college guys in last year's class. They need some of these guys, you know, to surprise people a little bit, and Mendenhall is one guy who could do that. Dylan Jones, you know, J.J. Altabelli. There's some guys here. They just need some of these guys to stick.
How about Marcus Piazzi?
Marcus Piazzi is another one, a junior college guy.
Phenomenal
from,
name.
From California, Santa Ana, I believe.
That's a phenomenal name. But I do think Oregon will get there in terms of being a regional team.
Yeah,
I would guess in the next 5 years they're going to be a regional team.
I think George Horton
and Andrew Checkitz are too good for that. And the other advantages you have at Oregon, the football program is fairly high profile, the Nike connection, the facilities there.
I bet there'll be a regional team by 2012, maybe 2011.
Well, they better be by 2012 because the world's going to end after that.
No, so. Is that right?
According to the Mayans, I mean, we're in trouble after that.
Their calendar expires.
That's right, sometime in December. But I think it'll get done there, but I think you got to have patience. Pac-10 is good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just talking to Michael Taylor the other day, the Phillies prospect. I know it's not as good right now maybe as it was, but the first pitcher he faced in college was Matt Garza. That's a non-conference game. And the Friday starters his sophomore year in the Pac-10 were ridiculous. It was like that 06 year with
Lincecum,
Brandon Morrow, Ian Kennedy, his own guy, Greg Reynolds, David Huff.
Dallas Buck.
Yeah, Dallas Buck, John Malone. Just lousy with big leaguers, basically. So that league is good, and it's especially almost always good on the mound. So that's where, to me, the Pac-10 has usually set itself apart. And if offense is a challenge for them, they better get used to that. It's always going to be hard to score runs in that league.
Right. So. And you know, John, even last year, it was one of the worst years in the Pac-10 in a long time. They only had three regional teams. They still had lots of talent in that league.
No doubt.
Just some teams that underachieved. So there's not going to be a year.
Oh, UCLA.
There's no comment. There's not going to be a year where there's just a vacuum like that for Oregon to step through. They're going to have to force their way through.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Well, how about this personal cheeseball class of Texas, Vanderbilt, and UCLA, speaking of the Bruins? It's a small Bruins class.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing is Texas's class has long-term potential, but I guess don't look for much from Texas's class in 2010. That's a pretty veteran club, those guys
are
stepping in.
They don't need a lot at Texas right away. I do think that you're going
to see... Who's the most likely guy to play this year?
I think Jonathan Walsh is going to play quite a bit because his bat is the most ready. And they could use him. They could squeeze him behind the plate or catcher, first, you know, DH, first base, corner outfield, kind of a situation there. He's going to hit. I think he'll play right away for them. They got some really good arms in that class. You know, Josh Urban and Hobie Milner and these guys. But they're more projection guys that you can look for down the road. They've got so many arms there. I don't foresee those guys being major contributors. I do like Cole Walla a lot. He's got five-tool potential, but he's very skinny, very skinny. Needs to get stronger.
He's like the John Henson of Texas baseball.
That's a great cross-sports comp right there.
Yeah, cross-sport, cross-racial, spanning the globe comp. Anyway, college basketball reference. Vanderbilt, as a personal cheeseball, is really interesting. Aaron, let's talk briefly about their class. Some great names on this class.
Yeah.
You got Mike Yastrzemski, grandson of Carl, right?
Yep.
Is he going to play any second base like Carl? No, he's a left-handed thrower, but we'll follow Yaz and see how that goes. You got Reagan, don't call me Ryan Flaherty, who I had, I guess it was actually the Mariners. I think he might have been the one who got away in the Mariners draft report card.
Interesting.
They really believe in that power eventually coming
through. Vanderbilt does too, and I didn't hear a lot about him from scouts in the Northeast this year. I think nobody really wasted their time to go see him. He was going to school. But Vanderbilt does sound excited about this guy. He could even be a two-way contributor for them. They like him a little bit off the mound as well.
I think that the Mariners made it sound like he was the guy they wanted to sign the most, and they did make a run at him. But I don't think money is an object for the Flaherty family.
Sure.
But then the big guy is Sam Selman, who was a late bloomer. I think if we had redone our top 200, say, in July – or after the draft, Sam Selman might have been on our top 200. He would have been. Would have had a bullet on our top 10. And, I mean, you wrote in here of a scout who told you this guy's going to be a first-round pick in 2012, and not just a first-round pick, a top of the 2012 draft pick.
Yeah, the guy I talked to, you know, a scout in that Texas area says he's going to be a top five overall pick.
Yeah, and I talked to a couple of directors doing draft report cards who also loved Sam Selman. So.
He's the real deal. I mean, if you're talking for a personal cheeseball player in this freshman class, that's the guy. I mean, it's a power arm with a really power curveball. He's raw yet. I mean, he's got some things to polish, but. Again, Vanderbilt's got plenty of arms. They don't need him to be the ace of their rotation right away, so that helps. I mean, and Connor Harrell is a guy who's kind of like that. He's a five-tool potential kind of guy, but he's raw, and he's like a little bit like Cole Walla, not quite that much upside, I think. Maybe a little bit more physical now, certainly.
Okay.
But he's got that kind of a tool set, I think.
Well, the other big question to me, Aaron, is that you look at the whole list, you know, Florida just stuck out at number one. They were number one from this time last year. With NLIs getting signed. And then even though they lost a lot of guys, including LeVon Washington, who didn't even sign the pro deal but didn't and winds up at junior college. And despite some of their losses, they still are number one by a significant margin, it seems like. And you have Florida State not in the top 25. Miami toward the bottom.
Yeah.
Central Florida's recruiting class is on here.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, second year, really the first big class for Terry Rooney where he's been in charge the whole time.
Right.
I don't see South Florida. I don't see any of the Florida schools. How much is Kevin O'Sullivan cleaning up in the Sunshine State?
You know, he really is. It's put it this way. I talked to a scout down there who said he saw, for the first time he can remember, he saw Jim Morris out on the recruiting trail at some showcase event down in Florida recently. You know, that just shows you people are a little bit worried that Florida's taking over down there. I mean, Florida really beat everybody badly this year. And granted, you know, they had some needs. They had the roster flexibility to do this. But this isn't a huge class that Florida brought in. It's not that much bigger than a lot of other classes.
It's not their Arizona State
right.
Bringing in 20 guys.
They did have some, you know, they had some scholarship money freed up, and they were able to do this. But, yeah, Florida's class is insane. And I think that they're in position now to be John, I mean, the dominant power in that state going forward. I mean, which is crazy to say because Florida State is good every year, Miami's good every year,
yep.
And they have good facilities and great coaches, and those programs aren't going to go away.
Right.
But, you know, and let's see Florida get to Omaha before we crown them, as Green would say.
That was true in football as well.
Yeah.
Miami, Larry Coker had won a national championship. Florida State was Florida State. So those two teams were vulnerable because those head coaches, Bobby Bowden now almost 80, Larry Coker clearly wasn't the guy. But look what Florida has done in football. I really think it's analogous. I think there's, and you know, Florida wasn't that bad just too long ago, 2005 with
right.
Omaha. So Florida has never been able to sustain baseball dominance. They've had some peaks, but they've never been able to sustain it the way Miami and Florida State have. And I think most of the credit for that at Miami, you know, has to go to Jim Morse. You know, the last 16 years, he's done a great job at University of Miami. And obviously Mike Martin, the most consistent program, really, in college baseball is Florida State. I mean, but Miami's been to, what, 31 regionals in a row? It's a record. Florida State's right after them. So it's incredible consistency of those two programs. But Florida is gaining, and I don't think there's any question that that recruiting class is kind of a signal. They were in on every top player in the state, and the same cannot be said for Miami or Florida State.
Right.
That's correct, right?
You know, they just have a much different recruiting philosophy than Florida State, though. I mean, you hear it from everybody. Florida State does so much of the recruiting out of their camps, and, you know, they don't scour the state, I think, the way that Florida does. And it's worked for Florida State. It's been a winning formula for a long time. And this
Absolutely.
Year, even they've you know, Jace Boyd for Florida State, it still gives them a marquee
Lead
player
guy, yeah.
in their class. And,
and he's moving to the infield after playing a lot of outfield, I think, in high school.
I believe you're right.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, you know, I still think Florida State and Miami, like I said, they're going to be factors. But I do think that every piece is in place now for the Gators. They've got, you know, obviously that school is an athletic powerhouse in
no doubt.
Multiple sports. And now they've got, a coach who really knows what he's doing, a great recruiter and a great pitching mind. I like his assistance there.
Yeah.
And they've got a great talent base. 2 years in a row they've had top, you know, five or six classes here. There's no reason to think that this won't continue.
There's something going on there. There's no doubt there's something going on there. I guess Central Florida really is kind of, to wrap this up, they're kind of like the one school that's ranked pretty high that you don't usually see in these recruiting rankings.
Sure.
What was the story of that recruiting? Is Ronnie Robertson, I think that's the kid's name.
Ronnie Richardson, yeah.
The kid the Twins drafted 11th round. Was he the difference maker in that recruiting class for you, or what prompted him to be ranked so high?
Yeah, I think he really has a chance to be an electric college player, just a a short, compact athlete with premium speed. He does have a lot of bat speed. He's going to be a good defensive player. I mean, he's just a I think he's just going to be electric. And you know, Darnell Sweeney gives him another elite up-the-middle talent, although his bat is a little bit raw right now. But I think he's going to be a very good defensive shortstop. And, again, a speed guy. Got some good arms in this class. I mean, Alex Bisaw from Skagit Valley, CC of in Washington.
Right.
The guy that, Connor Glassy heard good things about this spring doing draft calls up the Northwest. I mean, he's a quality junior college transfer who's probably going to be their Friday starter. So,
some of these guys, this pretty strong-looking junior college group they brought in, give Central Florida a chance to compete immediately and be a regional contender in Conference USA, where there was obviously a little changing of the guard last year with Rice not winning the conference, but also East Carolina having an older club. They're going to lose a lot off that club. And then Southern Miss getting to Omaha last year. Can they be in the mix with those teams, or are they still probably after that top trio in Tulane?
I do think they're a step below that tier. I think that Rice is still going to be Rice. Rice is going to have the best offense in the country, I think.
Especially if Rendon comes back healthy from that ankle injury.
Certainly.
He's certainly the key there.
I think Southern Miss is going to be good once again. They've got a lot back from their Omaha team, although they certainly lost some seniors. But
B.A. Volmuth.
B.A. Volmuth's prime for a big breakout year.
Great name.
And East Carolina, they still got a lot back. I mean, yeah, it was an older club, but they've got Kyle Roller back. They've got
some arms back. Those are Cape Cod
League
MVP,
wasn't it? Cape Cod League MVP, Kyle Roller, and Cape Cod Playoff MVP, Kyle Roller.
Grief.
They've got plenty back in East Carolina. Tulane's going to be a lot better. I do think Tulane's a regional team. I have a hard time seeing UCF being in that top four. I do think they're going to compete for a regional spot, but I don't see it happening for them this year.
Well, Aaron, I know I haven't broken it down like you have, but we'll end the podcast. What's your if you had to do a top 25 right now, what's your top five teams? Or you can just tell me a number one if you want to. But
I mean, I think Texas and Virginia are the two shoe-ins for the top five. I think probably those two teams are going head-to-head for number one.
Those are the first two teams I think of.
Yep.
Texas just returned so much of the pitching from last year.
Yeah.
Plus a lot of the hitting. I mean, Cameron Rupp and Kevin Keyes and
Brandon
Loy. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of ammunition back from a team that nearly won the national title last year.
Bingo. Virginia, of course, is just so deep and all over the place. I mean, they lost
Bob Morey.
They lost Caraway and they lost Packer, and that's it. Everybody else is back, basically, on that team.
That should be a pretty good ball club.
And they're going to be incredibly deep and athletic in the lineup too, because they've got a great freshman class, and none of those guys are even going to have to step in and play right away necessarily. So
the athleticism is just such a separator in college baseball. Yeah. If you have athletic ability with guys up the middle, like a guy like a Jarrett Parker. What's the shortstop's name there again? He was a pretty good defender. Tyler Cannon. It just stands out. That's how Nebraska, with Dave Van Horn, made their jump here a decade ago. They had speed and athleticism, guys like Jamal Strong, or even a shortstop, a guy like Will Bull, I forget their second baseman, Cole, I think was his name. These kind of athletic guys who could run better than average speed in the average college team. It makes up for a lot of other mistakes, the college level especially. So,
and I think, John, a couple more teams in the mix. Really like Florida State's club. I mean, they've got their entire weekend rotation back. They've got the core of their lineup with Tyler Holt and Stephen Cardullo and Stuart Tapley and Mike McGee. All those guys are back. They're going to be very good. I think that Florida's going to be very good. We talked about them. LSU should be fine again.
Florida State was very young on the mound last year, if memory serves.
Yeah.
Those guys are all back as
well. Two freshmen and a sophomore in the weekend rotation.
Florida State, who was the other team you just mentioned?
Florida, LSU.
Oh, LSU, yeah.
Certainly. I mean, Rice is going to be good once again. Cal State Fullerton, of course.
And Irvine.
And Irvine, absolutely.
Irvine should be good. I mean, Daniel Babona back.
Both those teams, Irvine and Fullerton, I believe, have their entire weekend rotations back. They both do.
The big thing to watch, obviously, with Fullerton is Christian Colon, our summer player of the year from the college ranks. How does he come back from that broken leg? I mean, it's the best part of my workday, Mondays during the college season, doing the podcast, getting fired up. I love listening to the podcast from the Selection Sunday last year. That was our Selection Monday. That was a lot of fun. It's always good to pop a bust a blood vessel over getting angry about things that people do about
why,
the
Why not?
About. We enjoy college baseball. We hope you enjoyed the discussion of the recruiting rankings and also the top tens. All the National League East top tens will be up by the end of this week, and we'll keep on rolling with the prospect handbook coming out right after the winter meetings, basically in mid-December. So you can order that at baseballamerica.com, and you can send us emails for next week's podcast where we'll talk a little bit more about the National League Central lists at podcast@baseballamerica.com. Until next time, for Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time. So long, everybody.